aquifers and watersheds. Understanding our water resources. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Episode 4. Streams, snails, and invasive species. We're back. As promised, we are heading out into the field in this episode, where you'll get to meet Tim Campbell, an outreach specialist with the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant. In the struggle to sustain robust and healthy water resources, our watersheds are the trenches where the battle must be won, and this is where you'll find scientists like Tim. Tim's job can be a tough one, but he has a remarkably upbeat attitude, and I think you'll find, like I did, that his cheerful disposition is quite infectious. I'm out here by Black Earth Creek. It's right outside Cross Plains, Wisconsin. You can hear 14 in the background, cars rolling by. I'm here today with Tim Campbell, and there's a reason why we're here. Something very unusual has been discovered. He's going to talk about it and give you the lowdown on this. This is quite intriguing. To start out with, the creek doesn't seem to be raging today. It's a late fall day in November. A little bit chilly, but not too bad. Tim, why don't you give everybody your full name, rank, and serial number?
My name is Tim Campbell, and I'm an aquatic invasive species outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant program and started in Wisconsin 2.5 years ago.
Okay, one thing, wildlife. One thing we're seeing right here, what is that USGS thing hanging from that bridge?
The USGS has a network of river gauges and creek gauges across the country, and there's a pretty cool resource online where you can go in, and wherever they have these gauges, there'll be data about the river level, the flow, and all that kind of stuff. So I found it really useful when I was doing my research. I couldn't get to every stream every day to check the water level, but I could get an idea of, you know, how high the river was or the creek was I needed to work in just to see if I could sample in it or not.
The thing that we're looking at, it's a small cylinder about 4 inches in diameter and about 2-3 feet long, with holes in the bottom 2/3 of it, and you could see how you'd be able to monitor water levels and probably how fast the stream's flowing, things like that. So why are we here today? What is so unusual that brought us out to this particular spot?
Well, last Thursday, about a week and a half ago, I got an email from some DNR colleagues, and there had been a discovery of the New Zealand mud snail in Black Earth Creek, exactly where we stand. And this is significant because this is the first inland discovery of New Zealand mud snails in the Midwest. The New Zealand mud snail, it's a small operculate snail, so it has an operculum, a trap door that allows it to close itself off from its environment. And it's the first time it's been found inland in Wisconsin. It's been found in the Duluth Superior Harbor in Lake Superior. It's been found in Lake Michigan in the Waukegan Harbor. But this is the first real inland population. Other than that, the closest inland populations are in Pennsylvania and Colorado.
So people are probably wondering, okay, how did that mud snail get all the way from New Zealand to Black Earth, Wisconsin?
Black Earth, Wisconsin, there's a couple of different ways it could have gotten here. Initial invasions into the United States from New Zealand, where it's obviously native to, could have ranged anywhere from aquaculture equipment or even live fish. These snails can pass through a fish's digestive system and still be viable upon coming out the other end. So that's how they think the Western New Zealand mud snails got to the United States. But populations found in the Great Lakes, they believe, were brought here via ballast water, like a lot of other invasive species. But Black Earth, Wisconsin, New Zealand mud snails have been known to hitch rides on anglers' waders, especially felt-soled waders that have a bunch of porous material on the bottom. Those waders are really nice when you're walking on mossy rocks. It gives you a little bit more grip, but it provides a really great habitat and environment for a lot of invasive species. It stays moist a while, allows things to survive long transport times.
Now, why are people concerned about this particular type of snail? It sounds fairly innocuous, just a tiny little snail. Is it going to hurt anybody? What's going on?
Well, like a lot of invasive species, it can reproduce quickly and it gets really abundant. They have been found, I think, in the Yellowstone area to get over 500,000 individuals per square meter. So you can imagine 500,000 tiny little snails in a meter. You would just be stepping on snails the entire time. It's not a very attractive sight in a beautiful trout stream, but you can also imagine a lot of snails eat a lot of food, and they don't provide good food for the fish in the stream, which a lot of people go to these streams to fish for trout. But then these snails compete with other macroinvertebrates or little stream insects for food. And if they're out competing the good food resources, then there's less food for fish and smaller or fewer fish.
I know we were talking earlier about how watersheds are perceptual regions and how you have to break down your areas that you work in to do your job effectively. And you mentioned that you look at it not so much as species, but as pathways. I thought that was interesting. Can you explain that to the people that are listening?
So if we get caught up in thinking about what we need to do to prevent an individual species to get into a watershed or a body of water, we might be missing out on things that we could be doing to prevent other species, because what works against one species might not work against a different species. So before the New Zealand mud snail got into Black Earth Creek, we were telling people that you could bleach your gear, or you could dry your gear for a couple of days, and that would be an effective way to prevent the spread of invasive species. But with New Zealand mud snails in the creek, now we've had to alter those recommendations because New Zealand mud snails can survive for over 25 days outside of water, which is pretty remarkable for an aquatic species. If we just focus on a single organism, we miss out on some other prevention activities. So when we think about pathways and how to mitigate the risk from all these different pathways, it really simplifies things.
And of course, one of the main pathways for invasive species is watersheds, right?
Right. As we stand here in, you know, a stream, a lot of times I spend my time thinking about lakes, and lakes are islands of habitat. And if an invasive species is found in a lake, a lot of times it's that one lake and it's that island. It doesn't spread and you can contain it. When we find things in streams, there's the potential for them to move up and down the stream. They can migrate upstream. They can attach to plants and float downstream. So I think of streams as these highways or bridges between islands. And so it really complicates the issue when you find a new invasion in a stream.
What do you think are the biggest challenges in terms of particular invasive species and the whole challenge of invasive species in general?
I think the biggest challenge with invasive species may not be a particular invasive, but definitely it's people, getting people to do all these prevention activities, because some people still don't think it's important. They don't think it applies to them. They just don't think they would be the one person to introduce an invasive species someplace. So dealing with the organisms tends to be a lot easier than dealing with the people. They have defined environmental tolerances. They don't have opinions on things. People, not so much.
Speaking of people.
Yeah.
And we're standing by a bridge. I think I mentioned that. They weren't really trying to get us. Do you ever feel that working invasive species prevention is a bit of a Sisyphean task? That poor lone soul from Greek myth that is doomed for eternity to push a rock up a hill just to watch it roll all the way back down to the bottom?
It's always an uphill battle working with invasive species because there's not a lot of positive news that comes out of it. Any positive news is always some sort of project where you removed a bunch of invasive species.
Hang on. We've got some real life farm machinery coming through. I found it interesting that even while we watched the road, Tim kept one eye on what was happening in the creek.
There's a fish that's really active right there. About every minute, it's surfacing. Kind of impressive.
What kind of fish are you seeing there?
I'm sure there's some sort of trout, probably rainbow or brown trout.
Uh-huh.
Wish I got to fish the stream more and wish I could tell you.
Don't you get a lot of fishing in your job? Or even a little bit?
Not at all.
Really? Oh, that's too bad. You said it's a bit of an uphill battle.
Yeah, it's a bit of an uphill battle because it's hard to get good news out of invasive species work. The good news all comes from there's an existing invasion and somebody pulled milfoil out of a lake, or they cut down a whole bunch of Phragmites from a beach or something. But it's a lot of bad news. You do all this work. The River Alliance of Wisconsin has done a lot of work educating anglers in Black Earth Creek, and that's something to celebrate. But then they just got this big chunk of bad news that New Zealand mud snails are in the Black Earth Creek, which they've put a lot of work into. So sometimes it's tough to keep going when you get all that news, but every day we prevent invasions, there's some sort of positive impact from that.
So if you keep an invasive species out of a trout stream, even for a couple of years, there's measurable economic benefits for the state then, right?
Right. In the example of the New Zealand mud snail, every year we enjoy a stream without New Zealand mud snails or another invasive species. It's another year we enjoy world-class trout fishing in the Driftless region. Trout streams, we're bringing in people from not only the region, but the nation and even the world to come fish these streams. So the longer we prevent invasions, we keep these pristine ecosystems, it keeps bringing people in.
How do you approach your work? Do you break it down into different watersheds? Do you break it down into different cities and areas around that? Or how do you organize your work in your mind to do it effectively?
I think a lot about cities, but when I'm on the Great Lakes coast, I think a lot about the tributaries to the Great Lakes and the watersheds there. If we think about maybe Asian carp, there's only a handful of rivers in Wisconsin that are suitable for Asian carps to reproduce in. So maybe focusing an Asian carp message in those river watersheds is the most effective and efficient way to spend my time talking about Asian carp. The Root River in Racine, probably not a great river for Asian carp. So maybe don't need to spend as much time down there as I would say the Sheboygan River.
To do your job, you have to know outreach, you have to know media, you have to know biology. What's your background? How did you get to where you're wearing a Sea Grant windbreaker and talking to people about invasive species? How did you get to where you are?
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My dad's a game warden in Iowa, so grew up hunting, fishing, and always thought that I'd be a game warden someday because it just seemed like the coolest job ever. So I went to school, studied environmental science. I went to Notre Dame, almost specifically because I knew they had a summer program where I'd get to go hang out in the UP of Michigan doing research. So I went there, I did that, and just thought that this was the coolest thing ever. I went to graduate school at Oakland University, north of Detroit, studied round gobies and tributaries of the Great Lakes, and was looking for a job close to graduation, and Wisconsin Sea Grant put out a position description for an aquatic invasive species outreach specialist, and it just seemed to fit me perfectly. So here I am.
I have to say I've seen Tim talk, and it's quite effective. He has an eye for engaging the audience. What else about this creek would people want to know about? What does the experienced eye tell us about this creek?
Well, it's a cold water fishery, which here in southern Wisconsin, maybe not something that immediately comes to mind, but a lot of these streams are spring fed or have some groundwater coming into them, so they stay cold and they're suitable for trout. A lot of the trout species in these streams aren't native to Wisconsin. The only inland trout that we have native to Wisconsin would be the brook trout. I'm not sure they would have been this far up natively, but trout bring a lot of people in. So these fish are stocked in here. They have the resources to not only survive, but reproduce and thrive. So just a fantastic fishery that a lot of people not only come to fish, but people from all over come to work on these streams to protect these streams and make it so that they're fisheries that people can enjoy.
Rainbow trout took over the world due to aquaculture. If you want to know more about that story, you should listen to our aquaculture podcast series. Okay, well, one last question. It seems like with invasive species, it's the pot calling the kettle black a little bit. Aren't humans invasive species, more or less? How do you look at that?
I get that question a lot. Aren't humans the biggest invasive species? But when I look at species spread, there is human-mediated spread, and then there's natural spread. If a species is getting from point A to point B on their own, that's natural spread. And if something that spreads naturally starts competing with another species, we may not like it, but that's nature. If we look at human-mediated spread, these are things that are moving faster than they would have been able to do on their own. And so those are things we generally call invasive species. When I look at how humans got all over the world, we did it all on our own means. We walked there, we maybe swam there. Perhaps we built an airplane or built a boat or something, but we got there.
Hitchhiked.
We got there by our own means. So I would say we're not invasive species because we got everywhere we are pretty naturally.
That makes sense to me. Okay, I lied. There's one more question because you told me in an email there's some kind of worm invasive species, and this is news to me. What's the story there?
Well, actually, most worms in Wisconsin are invasive. Everywhere where there used to be a glacier, there were no worms. If you can imagine, a mile of ice is not a very friendly environment to worms or other soft-bodied invertebrates. So all the worms we have here in Wisconsin were brought either through root balls of trees or bait bucket release or people just dumping their worms. So all these worms are not native. And a lot of people ask me, well, aren't worms good? Don't we want them in our garden? Worms are good in some places. They generally improve nutrient cycling, might help your plants grow. But when we think of our forests in Wisconsin, they evolved naturally without worms. So those dynamics are used to that slower decomposition, a little different nutrient cycling. When worms are present, it really tilts what kind of tree species can grow in those forests. So what does talking about forests have to do with standing at a stream? Well, some research has shown that even terrestrial organisms like worms can use streams as a corridor for dispersal. Who knows how the worms get in the stream, if they fall in, if people dump bait into the stream, but these worms can survive a week in the water and somehow they find their way out of water. So worms just fall in and find themselves downstream.
And if you had high water during the spring, that could be worms going considerably far down a watershed, right?
Yep.
Is any worm of particular concern right now to you?
There's no worm that's of particular concern to me. I wish I was more of a worm expert. But there's a lot of European worms, like the red wriggler, that are of concern. I had a fellow graduate student when I was in school. She studied Amynthus hilgadorfi, which is an Asian jumping worm. It lives in the top of the soil. And
he said Asian jumping worm.
We think that it's some sort of defense mechanism because when you touch it, it just starts freaking out and jumping all over the place. She found those for the first time in Michigan on the Oakland University Forest Preserve. So she did research there with those worms. That's the one I'm most concerned with.
Do you have nightmares of Asian carp?
I have nightmares about Asian carp if they were to get in the Great Lakes. I had a chance to go down to the Illinois River. I was looking for gobies in the Illinois River, but ran into more Asian carp and managed to get hit by my first Asian carp while I was down there. So definitely not good for recreation. I'd hate to see the effects they'd have on the Great Lakes. So I worry about those guys, but the species I'm concerned with from spreading from the Great Lakes inland, we obviously have zebra mussels a lot of places. Quagga mussels I'm concerned with because they don't need the hard substrates that zebra mussels can, so they might be able to inhabit more lakes. And spiny water fleas, they're only in a handful of inland lakes in Wisconsin, and those would just be an additional stressor to a lot of our already pretty stressed out lakes.
Tim, it's kind of chilly. Why don't we head back to headquarters and I'll let you continue on with your valuable and interesting work trying to manage aquatic invasive species.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode. It's time to get up and stretch your legs, but don't go too far because there's going to be another informative episode on aquifers and watersheds coming your way. This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Thanks for listening.